So tonight's talk is on the five spiritual faculties, and they are faith or confidence, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. And I'm taking Steve Armstrong's online course on the Manual of Insight, the book that he and Kamala oversaw the translation of, and it just happened that the last lesson I just did was on the five spiritual faculties, so I was furiously jotting down notes, and a couple of the favorite sentences from that. He said, "The five spiritual faculties are most responsible for the unfolding of our spiritual journey. They lead our practice from confusion, delusion, bewilderment to the wisdom of awakening." So that sounds like something I could sign up for. Out of confusion and bewilderment. There aren't a lot of suttas about the five spiritual faculties. They're kind of expanded on in the Visuddhimagga, the later commentaries that were done about 500 years after the Buddha. There were a couple. The one that was assigned, that was in our book, In the Buddha's Words, that we've been working with, sort of assumes that you already know what they are. So that's why I offered the other one at Access to Insight, because it only briefly mentioned them, and it only mentioned them in the context of sort of telling a beginner from a mature practitioner. And that's not really our concern here. For one thing, we're all beginners, including me. And the Western comparing mind is a very dangerous thing, and we kind of try to stay away from that whole thing here. So the one that I assigned actually went through, the one that I assigned was a translation by Thanissaro Bhikkhu called the Indriya Vibhanga Sutta, which is an analysis of the mental faculties, or the five spiritual faculties, which is in Samyutta Nikaya 48.10. And basically just goes through all five and says what they are. The two things that I'd like to emphasize tonight about these five are, first of all, that they lead in a kind of a spiral progression. So, you know, the order that these lists are given on, sometimes all these Buddhist lists that we have, sometimes that order means something and sometimes it doesn't. In this case, it very much is important to understand that order. So first thing, the concept that I want to pass on tonight is this sort of spiral progression from faith to energy to mindfulness to concentration to wisdom, and then back to faith, to increased faith, and increased each of them as we go. So that's a crucial concept that I want to pass on about these. And then the other thing is the way that they interact, both with each other and with their opposites. So this is the two main things that I'll try to pass on today. Tomorrow, Saturday, I hope to get into the way that these are broken down in detail in terms of in the Abhidhamma. All mental factors, not just these five, but all mental factors are broken down by their manifestation, their function, their proximate cause, what leads them to arise, and we'll get into that because it helps us really understand what something is when we understand all of those factors. So, but I don't think we'll get into that too much tonight. So let's just start with faith. And I know those of us that have been raised in various traditions in this country may have kind of a negative reaction to that word when we first hear it. It tends in traditional, in the more popular religions in this country, to have some implication of belief in something that isn't necessarily testable in our experience or in logic, and that's not at all what's meant by faith in this context. What's meant by faith in this context is a confidence in several things. First of all, is just a confidence in the teachings themselves, which you've exhibited just by showing up here tonight. In other words, you, whatever your motivation for being here, or your the most obvious intention, at some level there's operating something that is saying, well, I want to listen to this particular interpretation of the teachings of the Buddha because I might get something out of it. Okay? It's as basic as that. The second aspect of faith in this context is confidence in our own ability to practice. So that might sound like, well, I think I can actually do this practice, or this is the practice for me. This insight tradition, that's the practice for me. Or, you know, meditation really helps me. Or, gosh, you know, 5 years ago, I'm so thankful for the practice because 5 years ago, that experience that I just went through, I don't know if I could have gotten through it the way I did now with the practice. Those are all manifestations of saddha, of faith, of confidence in the practice. And the faith at that level inspires energy. It brings forth energy. When we believe that the teachings that we're studying are actually worth studying, when we believe, when we have confidence in our own practice, then when we practice, we actually get energy from that. Energy is released. Those of you that have ever been on retreat know that it doesn't seem to matter how long the retreat is. The first 3 days are like sleepy, sleepy, drowsy, drowsy. That's just the way it is. I don't know. Some people say it's the culture that, you know, that we're just constantly sleep deprived and we're pushing too hard and we're always striving, and to turn all of that off, or to turn off the natural stimulations of, you know, the internet and television and entertainment and meeting with our friends and chatting and all of that. Turning all that off can lead to a drop in energy. But what happens with time on retreat is that all of a sudden, a few days in, there's this energy that's released that we were sort of frittering away on things like chit-chat or entertainment, or, you know, just trying to get ourselves from A to B to C during the day, get all the chores done, you know, and get the to-do list written and get those things all checked off. You know, that takes way more energy than you might realize. And when you're in the midst of it, it's almost impossible to monitor how much energy that's taking. But when those things aren't there, it's really quite surprising the first couple of retreats you go on of this burst of energy that supports a real motivation to practice. Alan and I were just talking at the break about the way that this tradition is practiced in Asia, where, you know, they'll, as Steve puts it, you can sleep as much as you want up to 4 hours. You know. And with time, actually, that's about all you need, if that. There's just this momentum to the practice that the energy frees up. And in seclusion from all these other distractions that we have, that natural energy actually is inside, and it's just liberated. I mean, it's not like it has to be created. It's already there, but it's being spent on other things now that are freed up. So this confidence, both in the teachings themselves and in our own ability to do the practice, frees up a lot of energy. So this energy that we're talking about is not the kind of stick your finger in the wall socket, you know, light up kind of energy. You know, that sort of energy is like a sugar high. I mean, it'll carry you for, you know, 10 minutes or a half hour or an hour or maybe a morning, but then there's that crash, right? It's like the sugar high. When you have that kind of really intense vibrating energy, it doesn't last forever. And when it's gone, you know, you can tend to drop into kind of a very low energy and hard to get out of place. So the energy we're talking about here, this word virya is sometimes translated as perseverance. That kind of energy of just moment to moment, oh, I can do this. I don't. One of my teachers on my last retreat said, at the beginning of a 40-minute sit, she said, you do not need to call up the resources right now to sit for 40 minutes. Mm-hmm. And this is on a 6-week retreat, so it's a larger message, right? All you need to do is to call up the energy for the next moment. And that's the difference between this sort of striving and pushing and, oh, sitting down and gritting the teeth and saying, I can get through this 40 minutes, versus all I need in this moment is the energy for this moment. And then the next moment, and then the next moment, and the next moment. And that's perseverance. That's saying, as we move forward and as the practice builds its own momentum, oh yeah, well, I don't have to worry about 10 minutes from now, a week from now, 6 weeks from now. All I need to worry about is, in this moment, do I have enough resources to pay attention to my current experience? And the answer to that most often is yes. I have the energy in this moment to pay attention to my current experience. When we get drained is when we have to deal with the events of the past, the emotions, the thoughts, all of that, which is draining of energy, or anxiety about the future, or planning about the future, or worries about the future, or confusion, bewilderment, the other word, about the future. That's draining. But in this moment, do we have the energy to pay attention to our experience in the present moment, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, sensations, thoughts and emotions in the mind? Usually we do. And when we've got that faith to back us up, that confidence in the teachings and in our own practice, then almost always that energy is going to be there, that ability to persevere. Think of it that way. Think of this virya as being the ability to persevere, the intention to persevere, the intention, when the mind wanders, as it inevitably does, to just come back again and start over. I mean, just the starting over, that's virya, that's perseverance. That's, you know, the next time that the mind wanders off, just saying, okay, come on back, puppy, get back on your little blanket, gently bring it back. Training of the mind. That is the training. In this same course, Kamala does one of the guided meditations, and she says, coming back again and again is the training of the mind that we're actually engaged in here. That ability to remember, to recognize the present moment's experience, and then to bring ourselves back to the present moment, that's the training. It's nothing more fancy than that. It is simple. Not easy, but it is simple. Just remembering to come back. So when we have that kind of confidence, boistering and producing energy, or liberating energy that's already there, we are able to pay attention in the present moment, which is nothing more than mindfulness. So that's the next factor. And mindfulness is the ability to pay attention to the present moment's experience. Non-judgmentally, as Jon Kabat-Zinn says, paying attention in a particular way on purpose. So supported by energy. I mean, it takes energy. It doesn't take this, you know, striving kind of energy. It takes perseverance, the willingness to just come back again and again and again. That's mindfulness. That is the remembering, right? Smriti, sati is remembering. This root of that is remembering. And so we are remembering to recognize the present moment's experience. Mindfulness. So we have just enough perseverance, just enough resolve, just enough energy to pay attention to what our experience is, our direct experience, not what we think about it, not the concept of it, not the larger meaning of it, but the actual direct physical experience in this moment of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thoughts in the mind, energy, energetic shiftings in the mind, emotions, whatever you want to call them. Okay? That's all that mindfulness is. It's naturally supported by the initial confidence, the resulting energy, and the mindfulness. Now, moment-to-moment mindfulness, as Sayadaw Utejaniya says, it's not hard to pay attention. What's hard is to do that continuously. And that's the challenge in this practice, is moment-to-moment mindfulness. So when we say moment-to-moment, what we actually mean is moment-to-moment ad infinitum. Moment-to-moment-to-moment. Continuing to come back, using that perseverance to remember in this moment and the next, to stay with our shifting experience and to be able to actually know what's happening in that moment. That is concentration. Concentration is the collectedness and stability of mind that allows us to stay with the current object. And as you know from insight practice, that does not mean locking our mind on a single object, right? I mean, that's a perfectly legitimate practice. And often when we hear the word concentration, that's what we think it means exclusively, is the ability to put the mind on an object and keep it there. That's a valuable skill that comes and stabilizes the mind, but it doesn't bring wisdom. And insight practice is about understanding the nature of things, the characteristics of the way things are, and the first characteristic of the way things are is that they're changing. It's anicca. It's the first characteristic. So we know from our experience that things constantly change. We know that we constantly change in relation to our experience. The ability to stay with experience as it changes is actually a better way to think of concentration. It's a collectedness or stability of mind that allows us to be present for experience no matter what arises. Pleasant, unpleasant, bewildering, something we've never experienced before. Any of those are legitimate objects of our awareness. And the collectedness of mind to not be distracted by our usual habit patterns of planning, regretting, remorse, wishful thinking, fantasy, all of those patterns that often are ruling the way that we go through our day, the ability to actually put those at bay by having a collectedness of mind supported by remembering to recognize the present moment's experience, mindfulness, supported by energy and perseverance, supported by purity of our intention and our ability to connect with our highest aspirations in the teachings of the Buddha and in our own ability to practice it, and the one I've been leaving out on purpose until now, the ability to be actually awaken. That's the other one, that's the other aspect of confidence. Besides ability, you know, belief in the teachings, the belief in our ability to practice them, is actually belief in the possibility of awakening. So when we have all these things happening, we have, you know, this initial confidence, the energy resulting from that, the mindfulness resulting from that, concentration, which is really nothing more than mindfulness more continuously, rather than a moment of mindfulness, moment by moment by moment by moment mindfulness. That's stability of mind, collectedness of mind, samadhi, concentration. Which leads to insight. That's why we're here. Insight meditation, Sacramento insight meditation. The purpose of calming and stabilizing the mind is not to bliss out. It's not to get away from the horrors of the daily news. although I'd recommend that practice every once in a while. It is not to, avoid our responsibilities as family members, you know, community members, civic involvement, whatever your work environment is. It's none of that. It's to actually engage in all those things, but to do it with some kind of perspective on the way things really are, not the way we want them to be. So wisdom cannot be willed into existence. It's supported by our intention, supported by our intention to awaken. It's supported by our intention to maintain a moment-to-moment mindfulness. But wisdom just arises from the conditions that we establish. And so the first four are the conditions. Wisdom is the result. We set up the conditions, and then these insights arise, and we come to understand the way things really are, not just the way we want them to be. So in that way, each of these supports the other in a kind of a spiral fashion. Now, there are insights and then there are insights, right? I mean, there are these little moments when we realize, oh, that's not quite the way I understood things to be. Or, oh, you know, I've really never looked at a leaf in that way before. That's really interesting or fascinating or beautiful. There are those. And then there are, you know, the larger insights into the patterns of the way our mind works, you know, which with a little bit of practice, we start to see into that. We start to see the attitude of mind that we hold in our formal meditation starts illuminating the way that we're behaving in our daily life and in our interactions with others. And those kind of insights are a little bit bigger, a little bit more all-encompassing, a little bit more profound, a little bit more shaking the foundations of things. And then there are the insights into anicca, anatta, and dukkha, into impermanence, into the fact that things aren't stable, that they are conditioned, that nothing has an inherent meaning or an inherent thingness to it, that everything's in process, which is the anatta characteristic, and then the characteristic of dukkha, you know, as Heather says, the rope burn that we get from trying to hold on to things that are changing constantly, as that, you know, the experience of things aren't really stable and things are changing all the time, and we want to hold on to that rope tightly, and it's not possible. So as that rope pulls through our hands, we get the rope burn, which is dukkha, which is unsatisfactoriness. I mean, suffering is a really huge word, but for various reasons, that's been the most commonly accepted translation. But Tanasara Bhikkhu translates it as stress, simple as stress. Some people will translate it as dissatisfaction, discontent, unease. You know, even dis-ease. If you think about the body, the out of balance way that we feel when we're ill, you know, that's actually the condition of the mind when we're suffering, when we're in dukkha, when we're grasping onto what we want or grasping for something that we don't have, that we think we want, that we think is going to bring us permanent satisfaction, or that we're pushing away things that we don't want. We're not acknowledging the way things are in this moment for now. When we're not acknowledging that, we're pushing it away. That's dukkha. The original meaning of dukkha comes from the axle on a cart. Think about a wooden axle. After a while, that pin that goes into the hub of the wheel is going to get loose, right? Because you've got wood on wood in the original carts that were around in the time of the Buddha. And as that loosens up, you know, you've got an out-of-kilter ride on a bumpy dirt road. And that's dukkha. It's just that bumpy ride. It's the bumpy ride of life. It's just never... or never. I should never say never. It is very seldom smooth and easy for a very long period of time because it'll always change. And when things get smooth and easy, we want to hold on to them. And in the very holding on, we've we've gotten rid of smooth and easy, right? Because by holding on, we're setting up the conditions for dissatisfaction, anxiety that it's going to go away. So that's why sometimes people think that dukkha can only arise from unpleasant experiences, but that's not true. It can arise from pleasant or unpleasant. It can arise from neutral. You know, if neutral experience ends up, we're very uncomfortable with neutral. We don't know what to do with it, you know. We would much rather be liking or disliking something. We'd really rather dislike something than have it neutral. Because neutral is bordering on boring. And at least for greed types like me, boring is like the last thing that we want in our lives. And so when neutral comes along, there isn't that kind of stimulation and excitement that we're sort of seeking, the new experiences that we're looking for. And so neutral leads to bewilderment. It leads to confusion, which is, that's ignorance, right? That's the third root of suffering, along with, you know, desire and aversion, is ignorance. So we have this ability in our practice to develop some insight into multiple levels of our human experience. And hopefully, with time, as we practice, as our practice matures, the insights become a little deeper, and quite frankly, shake the foundations a little bit more strongly. It's said that what we think we want when we're flowing through the stream of life is a rock to hold on to in that stream. This is a Doug Kraft thing. We want a rock to hold on to in that flowing stream. And what we actually need is the ability to just flow with the stream. So what we think we want is to grab onto this thing, but think about that. I mean, think about holding on to that rock as this stream is flowing by. That's a very stressful situation, a very tense situation, and you can only do it for so long. You can only hold on to that rock for so long. At some point, you're going to have to let go and hope there's another rock downstream you can grab onto. I don't know how many of you have been with Franz Muckel, the Qigong teacher, but he was in the tsunami in India. He was living on the coast of India when that happened. And when the first wave came, it actually went under his house was on stilts, actually went under his house. And then he saw the next one coming, and he realized what was happening, and he went out and he grabbed onto a tree, and his partner grabbed onto him, and the wave completely went over them, destroyed the house, took out everything that was inside of it, and then came back, hit him again, and by some miracle, he was, well, probably the physical training that he does. He's an amazing human being in the way he integrates this practice, this physical expression of mindfulness in his Qigong. And anyway, the wave came back, swept away everything they had, and there they were, you know, holding on to this tree. Well, you can imagine the stress of that. And that's the stress that we feel when we try to hold on to the rock in the middle of the stream and life is flowing by us, you know. If we're not willing to just say, okay, I'm going into the unknown, but here goes, and let go, we're never going to be able to develop those deeper understandings of the way things really are. Because the way things really are is that they're always changing, they're subject to conditions beyond our control, and if we try to oppose those two things, we're going to suffer. But accepting all of that and achieving some kind of insight at any level, whether it's, you know, some recognition of some, you know, thing that we've walked by 10 times that we've never actually seen before and actually seeing it, or whether that's an insight into the anatta characteristic, all of those will strengthen our faith. Will strengthen our confidence in the practice. When we've had an insight, you can't unlearn an insight. If you can, it's not a real insight. Experiential, non-cognitive insight that we're talking about here, those little intuitive awakenings that happen as a result of practice, those are the result of setting up conditions in our life to actually be open to that happening. And when that does happen, you can't unlearn it. Whatever was learned in that moment cannot be unlearned. And whatever was learned in that moment is a shift from your previous patterns and ways of approaching life and looking at life. But no matter what it is, no matter how small or how big it is, that's going to strengthen your faith in the practice. Because those insights, once they're integrated into our lives and we start living from that new viewpoint, as destabilizing as it may have seemed at first, is going to be a little bit of awakening and liberation, because we're more in line with the way things really are. When we're more in line with the way things really are, we're going to have more confidence in, first of all, in the teachings. Oh, you know, you've probably heard teachers say, well, you know, everything I've actually experienced in the practice has been true to the teachings. So I don't have that much skepticism about the teachings that I don't accept now, because maybe that's just something that I'm not able to experience right now. So as we do have these kind of widening, enlarging of our ability to experience things and to be more in line with the way things are, that strengthens our faith, our confidence, because we realize, oh, well, that teaching that I heard about that I just sort of accepted on blind faith or I doubted, all of a sudden now I realize that was actually true. And then that brings us more into line with the way things are. That strengthens our ability, that our confidence, which brings more energy, which brings more mindfulness, which brings the ability to collect the mind more, which brings more insights. But they're at a different level, right? Because each time, each insight is going to, you don't unlearn that insight, so it's there to help you understand the next insight, to get a little deeper with the next insight, because each one supports the next. Everything's subject to causes and conditions, right? So as we have one insight, that sets up the conditions for the next one. As we have a tiny little understanding of impermanence, that opens up our understanding for a larger experience of impermanence. And as these, that's why it operates as a spiral. It gets stronger and stronger. And as we have more insights, we have more wisdom, that strengthens faith, and the whole circle just keeps going. So that's the way I'd like you to look at these factors, not as you know, something to achieve, or how do I memorize that list of five, but to understand that they support each other in a very causal way, causes and conditions, each one supports the other, and to understand and to be able to recognize them when they actually happen in your life. You know, when you have a sitting, and at the end, you know, I always like to say at the end, well, check in on the energetic tone in the body. Well, when you have a sitting and you check your tone, energetic tone in the body at the beginning, and you feel like you've just been put through the ringer, and then check it at the end, and you actually have some little tiny element of calm and peace, you know, that is the practice actually working. So recognize that as energy arising from confidence. And then when you're sitting and all of a sudden you don't have to work at being mindful, it actually has some kind of momentum to it, recognize that. Recognize that that's being supported by your intention, by your faith, by your confidence, and then by the energy that results from that. So learn to recognize these in your life. The second thing that's important, so that was the first thing I want to talk about, is the cyclical nature and the mutually supportive nature. The second thing I'd like to get across briefly here is the way that they work with each other. So I think most of you are familiar with the seven factors of awakening. Three of them are energizing, three of them are tranquilizing, and mindfulness is in the center balancing them. It knows when we need more energy and it knows when we need more tranquility, and it balances those. In a similar way, mindfulness is at the center of the five spiritual faculties. So the first two are confidence and energy. Mindfulness is in the middle. The next two are concentration and wisdom. In this case, the two pairs across from each other need to be balanced. So we've got faith and we've got wisdom. If there's too much faith without wisdom, we fall into not verifying in our personal experience. We fall into believing what others say. We fall into book learning. We fall into taking other people's word for it. We're not actually experiencing life. We're not relying on our own personal experience. That invitation of the Buddha, Ehi Passako, come and experience for yourself this. You know, as we were talking last time about the Kalama Sutta, when he said, don't rely on tradition or, a spiritual book or the fact that your teacher has a great reputation or any of that. Rely on your own personal experience. That's what we're talking about here. If you have too much faith, too much confidence, and not too much confidence and not enough wisdom, then you're not going to be balanced in that way. If you have too much wisdom and not enough confidence, then it can be the insights won't be experientially based. You know, they may be more cognitive rather than based on your own experience. So mindfulness knows how to balance confidence and faith with wisdom, so that we're constantly testing our experience against what's actually happening in the moment, not on some concept or something we've read in a book of what kinds of experiences we should be having when we're meditating or any of that. The confidence and the wisdom are supporting each other because mindfulness knows how to keep them in balance. Similarly, energy and concentration, actually they're right across from each other in the seven factors of awakening too. But energy and concentration need to be balanced. So if we have too much energy and not enough concentration, we'll have restlessness in the mind and the body. If we have too much of that, you know, stick the finger in the light socket kind of energy, but we don't have the stability of mind, we'll just be restless. If we have too much concentration and not enough energy, then we get that sinking mind, it's called, where you're on the object, you're on the object, you're on the object, then all of a sudden, you just slip off because the mind says, oh, I think I've got this. It quits working. It quits investigating. It quits moving forward with the moment. It's like, oh, well, I have achieved something. It's mistaking thingness. You know, it's thinking that thingness, that concentration is a noun, when actually it's a verb. It's a moment to moment to moment to moment to moment to moment awareness, remembering to recognize present moment's experience. So it's thinking, oh, I've got it. You know, you get one of these spiritual goodies, you know, you get a little puff of bliss, you get a little PT, you know, you get that, you just start laughing, or, you know, that those spiritual goodies that come along with concentration, right? That calm and stability of mind is a wonderful state. And really, if it's in balance, the sukha, the happy comfort of body and mind is the proximate cause. It's the thing that allows concentration to even happen. So when we have those things present, we want to really hang on to them, but then the energy drops because we're not staying with the present moment. You know, we're sort of grabbing onto something. We're grabbing onto, oh, that moment of peace, or boy, I was really connected with the breath for that, you know, for that few consecutive moments, and then stopping there. And just saying, oh, I know what the breath is. And then sinking mind comes along because the energy isn't there. So mindfulness is monitoring the energy in each moment, and it's monitoring the level of concentration, the level of moment to moment to moment. Because it's remembering. Mindfulness is remembering and remembering and remembering from moment to moment. So it doesn't allow that mind to just grab onto something and sink. It's sinking from the weight of holding onto something. So mindfulness keeps energy and concentration in balance. It keeps faith or confidence and wisdom in balance. And in that way, we have a harmony, what's sometimes spoken of as the harmony of the five factors. When all five of those are perfectly in harmony, that's called awakening. As actually in the Manual of Insight, Mahasi Sayadaw says, a harmony of the five spiritual faculties is awakening. So it can happen. And anytime that you experience a balance between those, anytime you notice that your energy and your concentration are in balance, that's a little momentary nibbana. That's a little moment of actually understanding a little bit of awakening in this moment, in this life. So whether you believe in the possibility of complete liberation of the mind from all suffering or not, understanding the confidence in the practice and in ourselves and in our own ability to awaken, or if you prefer, in our own ability to actually accept the way things are a little bit more than we did yesterday, you know, if that's as far as you can go, great. You know, that in itself will build your confidence. So that's a brief five faculties in a nutshell. Any questions, comments, complaints? Registrations for the day long?
I like what you said about the energy and how much energy we expend in our day to day life, to do lists and all that. That resonates with me. Can you discuss that further, or any homework that we can practice on that? Or, you know, I think I get myself pretty busy.
Some of these little reminders, either a timer or a place that you go to repetitively, are little reminders, are mindfulness reminders during the day. And what you can do when your mindfulness, either a timer goes off or something on your computer says wake up, or there's various little apps you can get that'll do that. Or if you have like a certain doorknob that you go to several times during the day, you know, remember that's your mindfulness reminder, the doorknob. Or like when I was in a paid working situation, picking up the phone for me, because I had a couple bad experiences with being unmindful or being busy when somebody called or something like that. So I would always, when the phone rings, just and then pick it up mindfully. And so the touching the phone would be when they used to, when phones used to have like handles and they had this little wire that, never mind.
Wait, what?
Yeah. Wire. Talk to you later about what those were. But the actual act of touching something repetitively that you know you're going to go back to during the day, in that moment, for say 1 week, rather than checking your breath or checking whatever, check your energy level. And notice in that moment, what's my energy level, just during the day. And so you will notice, well, speaking from my own experience, what I noticed is when I did that, actually just doing that during the day, even like five times in an 8-hour day, increase the energy. Because as we've talked about, mindfulness has momentum. Mindfulness builds momentum. Actually, the proximate cause for mindfulness is a previous moment of mindfulness. So when we have one moment to moment to moment to moment mindfulness, then it's building momentum, it's building the energy. If we don't, then we're getting more, or what I would experience, you get more and more and more and more and more and more contracted. It's almost like, you know, putting a weight on a piece of styrofoam, you know, and just gradually it, you know, compresses very, very slowly. And, you know, during the workday, if I wasn't checking in periodically and checking on my energy level, what would happen is I get more and more contracted, the mind would get more and more small, and the energy would just get drained out, get pressed out. Actually, the energy just gets pressed out. It's not able to express itself because of the contraction and the tension. So if you build in some of those reminders during the day, and you take that moment to just say, well, what's my energy level? That checking in itself will expand the mind a little bit, will actually open things up a little bit, will release tension a little bit. And as a result of that, there'll be more energy. And then you'll find if you do this for like a week, as you go through the week, there'll be just a little bit more energy each time you check it. And then that gives confidence. Oh, I don't have to have that 3 o'clock cup of coffee that I used to need. Because I have a natural energy that carries me through that post-lunch, you know, because I'm checking my energy at some regular interval. So, try that. If it doesn't work, blame me. Yes?
You talk about having more and more and deeper meditation to have more insight.
Uh-huh.
And talk about having a mature practice.
Uh-huh.
So how long do you think one has to practice in order to reach that level?
At the time of the Buddha, about 5 minutes. There were people that came to him and said, look, you know, they had this huge spiritual urgency, it's called Samvega, you know, and they'd come to him and they'd say, hey, look, I don't have much time in this life, you know, give me the teachings right now, in brief. And he did, and they were awakened in that moment. Nowadays, not so much. So, there is no formula. There is no particular linear step-by-step progression when you can say, oh, my practice is mature now. It wasn't mature 5 minutes ago, you know. What we would hope in is that our practice would always be awake and alive and fresh, that we'd always be able to notice these factors, these five factors, actually notice them. Well, how strong is our confidence? How strong is our energy? How strong is our mindfulness, concentration, wisdom? How strong are they? And to notice those with time, and then to be able to say after 5-10 years, oh, yeah, my confidence is stronger than it was 5-10 years ago. You know, all of these factors are a little bit stronger than they were. And they say when your practice is fully mature, these spiritual faculties become the spiritual powers. The indriya become the bala. The spiritual faculties become the spiritual powers, and the only difference is that, I didn't get into the opposites, but they're fairly obvious. The spiritual powers are immune to their opposites. They're immune. They're completely steadfast against their opposites. So confidence is completely able to fend off doubt. Energy is completely able to fend off laziness. Mindfulness is completely able to fend off heedlessness. Concentration is completely able to fend off distraction. And wisdom is completely able to fend off ignorance, which is awakening. And there's no more ignorance, right? We see things the way they are, and our practice has matured, let's put it that way. So yeah, not to set up a comparing mind or anything, but every once in a while just to reflect on the benefits of the practice is the way I would put it. Reflect on the benefits of the practice, like I was saying at the beginning. You know, realizing, oh, that situation I went through last week, you know, 5 years ago I would have been a complete wreck. And now I'm only a partial wreck. And that's good. That's progress.
You just wanted to recognition of this sinking feeling.
Yeah.
And so I just wanted to explore that a little bit because, and there was, it would kind of refer to it in such a way that it would bring, it would then your evaluative, or what's the word that we use to look at something with?
Your perception?
No.
Oh, like your discernment?
Investigation?
Investigation? Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Like, somehow if this something is traveling through you in the body.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not investigating it.
Right.
At this point, what I'm making reference to is a place that emerges in meditation, which is the feeling of deepening within the body, and it feels very, very serene, very equanimous. And it's given. It's not somehow the conditions, whatever it is that, you know, has sort of been moving within,
mm-hmm.
is felt in a deep way. And sometimes I have a problem, or I'm not quite with maybe this whole practice a little bit when we talk about the mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's just a concept. The mind is just a concept.
Because the mind, because the four foundations of mindfulness, the body is very, very important,
mm-hmm.
you know, and the Buddha, you know, recognized how important the body was. And so sometimes so when you said that about that sinking feeling, and I feel it's a gift when it's presented, because it feels like the truth of equanimity.
Yeah, yeah.
Or that somehow it's a blessing.
Right, right.
Blessing.
So you're talking about your awareness dropping into the body, and a.
Well, it. But there's. I mean, there is a. But awareness in the body can be a different sort of qualities of awareness.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a different quality.
Right.
You know, there's so I just recognize this profound equanimous quality.
Right, right.
That's not always there when I'm meditating.
Sure.
You know, it's just offered.
Right, yeah.
So I was just wondering about when you were saying this sinking feeling.
Right. So we need to distinguish between sinking mind, which is a low energy state that results from holding on to a moment of concentration, trying to hold on to a moment of concentration, so that the mind actually slips off the present moment's experience, and you know, we fall asleep, or the mind goes off in thought, or whatever it might be. So sinking mind is actually a low energy state that there's no awareness there. What you're talking about is, and just be careful with semantics, it's not a place. I mean, the way you stated it at the end was, you know, it's a quality of mind that has some serenity to it, has some peace, it has some connection to the body, and it maybe doesn't have investigation in the sense that you're, you know, maybe asking questions like we might do at the beginning of a sitting, just to kind of prompt ourselves about, oh, well, what is this experience? That kind of investigation. But you are investigating in the sense of you're trying to get to the unique flavor of that moment. It's called the sabhava. that each mind state has its own unique flavor. And part of the purpose of this practice is to actually recognize the unique flavor of tranquility, the unique flavor of concentration, the unique flavor of happiness, the unique flavor of sadness, the unique flavor of all these mind states. And so there is an investigation going on, but you're right, it's not this sort of active mind kind of, you know, questioning everything or needing to prompt or needing to label or anything like that. The difference between the thinking mind and what you're talking about a very grounded, body-based awareness that results in tranquility, the difference there is that there's energy present in the second one. You know, and again, it's not this vibrating, you know, total body type experience of energy. It's just a very calm, steady, persevering energy that sustains the mind state and allows it to change into whatever it's going to change into next. So.
Thank you, Rich. You've given me a lot today, and I really appreciate how clear this has been brought to you.
Well, thank you. Yeah. Words are very inadequate to express some of these things, but it's fun trying.
excuse me. Early in your discussion, you were talking about, I guess, our modern life state of mind, where you might be here in the present, but you're dealing with stuff from the past.
Right.
Anticipation of the future.
Yes.
Later, you were talking about me.
Oh, okay. What I meant by remember is just remembering to recognize the present moment's experience.
Okay.
That's all. Rather than drifting off like our mind sometimes does into fantasy or a train of thoughts or an emotion that leads to a bodily feeling that leads to more thoughts that leads to another emotion, you know, that discursive kind of thinking. If we're remembering to be aware of the present moment's experience, I mean, right now, you know, the contact of my bottom with the chair and then my elbows touching the chair on the right-hand side and I'm seeing you and I have a less clear seeing of the other people in the room and I can hear the air conditioner going, all those actual physical experiences, to be able to stay with those as they change is what I meant by remembering. I didn't mean remember what I had for lunch or remember the terrible, you know, the terrible traffic jam I was in 2 weeks ago. That's not the kind of remembering I'm talking about. It's the moment-to-moment remembering to be aware of the present moment's experience.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, a thinking mind, too much concentration, or this happened when concentration was, as you mentioned, a noun. On one thing, one time, just counting. And I think I came up with the answer then, so to balance it with energy, I was thinking, well, then becoming aware of it then is the energy you need to balance it.
Right.
Is that a
yes, awareness.
Awareness.
Brings its own energy. That's right.
Then.
Yeah. And then awareness moment to moment, that's all concentration is. It's not some, you know, furrow-browed grabbing onto something. It's actually a quite free moment to moment sustaining of that, of remembering to recognize the present moment's experience from moment to moment to moment. That's actually what concentration is. You know, I think because of our academic training or whatever, we tend to think of concentration as being, you know, but it's more, just
beginner's mind, the way.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Sounds easy.
Right. It's simple, but it's not easy. Great. Well, we have come to the end of our time, so let's take a moment to, first of all, give thanks for this community and for our ability to practice together. And let's set an intention to recognize the confidence in the teachings and in our own ability to practice that has brought us here tonight. And really remembering that while it may appear so sometimes, this practice is not about self-centeredness or self-improvement, but it's really about the liberation of all beings. In any moment of awareness, we are giving a tremendous gift to both ourselves and to those around us. Any moment of insight is bringing a new perspective into our lives that can improve our relationships and ultimately this suffering world. So may we dedicate any positive things that have come out of tonight's practice together and our discussion of the Dharma to, in some real way, reducing the suffering of all beings in a world that needs mindfulness and compassion so desperately. And may we all, in some real way, be free from suffering, along with all beings. Thank you for your practice.